Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 155. I'm recording it on Tuesday, August 4th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 17. I started recording these podcasts last summer, a little bit before the stock crash. But ever since the stock crash, I've been announcing the PE10 level on each podcast, and it's been as low as 12. This is the first time it's ever been to 17 again since the crash. It's been as high as 16. And I've always been saying, I say the PE10 level. The reason I do this is because I believe the PE10 level is so important to stock investing that it should be reported in every day's newspaper. It should be reported as often as we report the Dow Jones average or the S&P average. They should always also report the PE10 level so that we can make an adjustment to the Dow Jones average or the PE10 or the S&P 500 level to know how that increase or decrease in the Dow Jones average affects our long-term return. So I believe you should never report the Dow Jones average or the S&P average without also reporting the PE10 level. If you want to know more about PE10, there's a separate podcast called PE10 Rocks. It was one of the earlier podcasts. So I adopted a practice with every podcast of reporting the PE10 level and then just giving a quick summary of what that means. And for this entire time period, the PE10 level has been between 12 and 16. And I've been saying stocks offer a strong long-term value proposition. That's in contrast to the situation from 1996 to 2008, when stocks offered a horrible long-term value proposition. A very, very poor long-term value proposition. Well, now that we're at 17, things are getting a little more dicey. If you look at the stock return predictor calculator at the website, you will see that the most likely return, the most likely 10-year annualized real return on stocks purchased at today's prices is 4.4% real. Now, that's not bad. That's certainly better than anything you can get from the super safe asset classes like TIPS or I-bonds or certificates of deposit. And those are usually the asset classes I use when stocks do not offer a good long-term value proposition. However, stocks are more dangerous than those asset classes, obviously. Stocks are far more volatile, and I believe investors should be compensated for taking on risk. So if you're going to take on the risk of stocks, you should be compensated. The rule of thumb that I usually apply is that if you're going to buy stocks, you want to get at least 2% real return per year better than what you could get in the super safe asset classes, or else stocks just aren't worth investing in. You're better to just go with the super safe asset classes and wait until stocks are providing an annual real return of at least 2 percentage points better. Well, the prices stocks have been at since the crash, it's always been at least 2% better. Now, today we are in somewhat unusual circumstances. We're living in the wake of the most out-of-control bull market in the history of the United States. Prices went to levels in the 1990s never before seen in history. Emotional extremes beget emotional extremes. So when you go to such insanely high valuation levels, in the wake of that bull market, you should expect to go to insanely low valuation levels. That means that the odds are that in the next few years, we're going to see another stock crash, probably dropping 50% from where we are today, dropping down to a PE10 level of 7 or 8, something like that. Well, given that reality, I believe that you should be compensated not with 2 percentage points of additional return today, but probably by 3 percentage points, given the highly volatile nature of stocks in today's environment. So, my view is the most likely annualized real return today is 4.4, according according to the historical data. My rule of thumb today is that if you can get a safe asset class that provides 1.4 in real return per year, it's essentially a draw. You're essentially getting an equal value proposition. Now, I haven't looked at the rates on TIPS and I-bonds and CDs lately, so I don't know if you can get 1.4, but my guess is it's somewhere in that neighborhood. You know, usually you can get 1.4. Sometimes you can get, at the best, you could get 4 points real, but that was exceptional. But usually you can get 1.4. So that means that the long-term value proposition of stocks and the super safe asset classes today is essentially a draw. There might be a little advantage to stocks. If you use the 2% rule of thumb, then stocks are probably a little better. I doubt that you can get 2.4 real today from those other asset classes. I don't know. I haven't checked. So I think it's essentially a draw. So I'm not going to, if prices remain as high as they are today, or for so long as they do, I'm not going to continue saying that stocks offer a strong long-term value proposition. I'm either going to say they offer a reasonably good long-term value proposition, which I think is a fair statement, or I might say the long-term value proposition of stocks is not terribly good, not terribly bad. Sort of a mixed message at this point. I think that's a more accurate statement than to say, as I have been saying, since September of 2008, that they offer just a strong long-term value proposition. Now, if we go to the next P10 level, 18, the annualized real return would drop to 3.9. If you subtract 3 from that, you're down to an equivalent. In a super safe asset class would be a return of 0.9%, less, you know, about 1% real. So if we go any higher, going to start doubting the long-term value proposition of stocks. But as of today, I still would say stocks offer a decent long-term value proposition. I think the odds are strong that we will see another stock crash within the next few years. But I think the odds are also strong that in 10 years, you will have made that money back plus something. You probably will have ended up with a long-term return in 10 years of something in the neighborhood of 4% real annualized per year. And that's not bad. So I don't think the long-term value proposition today is bad on stocks, but not quite as exciting as it has been. Certainly when it was at 12, it was looking very, very good. There was only a short time period when we were 12. But at 14 or 15, the long-term value proposition is very good. And it's just getting a little dicey now at 17. This is the first podcast where we've gone to 17. So the long-term value proposition today is reasonably good. I would not say strong, but reasonably good. Not too bad. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod, as always. He's at theincompetech.com. Kevin allows us to use this music free. So Kevin's a good guy. And if you have a need for music, if you're recording podcasts at your website, I would recommend you go to Kevin's website and check out what he has to offer. It's quite a deal. It's quite a deal. Thank you, Kevin. The title of this selection is Wexford. The title of the podcast is... Boy, we're 9 minutes in already. Holy moly. Just with the intros. The title of the podcast is The Retirement Risk Evaluator is not a conservative retirement calculator. It is an accurate retirement calculator. Now, another prefatory note, I've been working the last couple of days on a section at the homepage of the blog. I have some widgets on the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the blog page. If you want to go to the blog, go to passionsaving.com. That's the name of the site. Look down the left-hand side, and there are different buttons there to different sections of the site. And the way at the top is a button called A Rich Life. And A Rich Life is my blog. And if you go to the blog, click there, and you'll go to the blog homepage. And down the left-hand side of the page and the right-hand side of the page, there are widgets that give you links to all the best stuff at thepassionsaving.com universe. And also I have links there to John Walter Russell, the best stuff at John Walter Russell's site. John Walter Russell's site is sort of a sister site. John Walter Russell is a numbers guy extraordinaire. He has been helping the Retire Early and Indexing discussion board communities for 7 years now learn what the historical data really says about the effect of valuations on long-term stock returns. John's site is early-retirement-planning-insights.com. And I have links there on the widget at the bottom of the left-hand side to the best articles at John's site. So you can find all sorts of wonderful stuff at these links. I love the three-column format. It may not remain in place forever, so perhaps by the time you hear this podcast, it will no longer be true. But I personally love it. I don't know how many people take advantage of it, but I love being able to reach all the good stuff from one sort of central page, like a command module, you know. And it's got links to the best podcast that I've recorded, and the best articles at the site, and the best blog entries at the site, and it's got the blog role, so you can go onto some other blogs that I like, and it's got a list of the great safe withdrawal rate debate sites where those discussions have been held. All kinds of neat stuff. I want to get that three-column format at the main site so that all the pages at the site would have all these links, but I have a funny feeling that Iran is going to have nuclear weapons before I have the technical capacity to pull that off, but we'll see. But anyway, you can go to the site and look at all those links and find your way to all the best stuff, all the work that we have done over the past, 7 years on the investing stuff, and we started on the saving stuff in May of 99, so 3 additional years on the saving. So 10 years now, we've been building up our communities, the Retire Early and Indexing Discussion Board communities. So 10 years of, and the PassionSaving.com site is essentially a repository of all the best work of 10 years of work in the Retire Early and Indexing Discussion Board communities. We bring, you know, when we develop insights, I write them up in articles or blog posts or podcasts. And that's the idea of this site, is just to give people the best information, not from the stock selling industry, not from the people who make money marketing, you know, marketing certain pitches, marketing certain, you know, whatever you want to call them, strategies or marketing slogans or whatever. Our goal is to help middle-class investors, and we have middle-class investors working together, the smartest savers, the most effective savers, and the smartest, most effective investors in the world, coming together and sharing their ideas, and then I write them up at the blog and at the site and in books and all this sort of thing. Anyway, boy, if I ever get through the preface here, this will be some podcast. Anyway, there's a section there called People Are Talking. I've been filling that in. And the idea of the People Are Talking, that's on the left side of the homepage of the blog. And People Are Talking gives links to things that people have said about the work done in our community and at my website. And I like that because, some people will look at it as bragging. You know, these people make these highly complimentary comments, but people need it because I think the biggest problem we have in investing is, I've had many people tell me this. They say, Rob, all your stuff about investing makes perfect sense. It all adds up, but I've got a problem, Rob. This isn't what the big name experts are saying. And they feel funny. And they say, this isn't what the marketing campaigns are saying. The stock selling industry spend hundreds of millions of dollars saying timing doesn't work and stocks for the long run and buy and hold. And that's not what you're saying. And all that's true. But just because somebody spends $100 million marketing something doesn't make it true. But the human mind is so conditioned that we think it does. We think if we've heard it 1,000 times, it must be true. This is the secret of marketing. If you hear it 1,000 times, it must be true. Doesn't matter that there's no logic. Doesn't matter that it doesn't make sense. Doesn't matter that the entire historical record says otherwise. The entire historical record says long-term investors must time the market. They must pay attention to price. They must go with lower stock allocations at times of insanely high prices. The entire historical record says this, but the marketing campaigns do not. Well, the only way we're going to change that is to let people know. Now, the reason why people fall for these marketing pitches is human beings, our brains are set up to believe what lots of other people tell us, and that's not a bad thing. We don't have time to research everything on our own, and a shortcut way of knowledge is to hear what other people say. And so when we hear other people say things, our minds believe it, even if it happens to be a marketing pitch. So in order to spread valuation-informed indexing, in order to spread good investing ideas instead of the bad passive stuff, we need to let people know that it's not just one guy in a room that thought this stuff up. It's not just Rob Bennett and John Walter Russell that believe in rational investing. We've had hundreds of people contribute to our discussions, and we've had thousands express a desire that honest posting be permitted at all the boards. So there are lots and lots and lots of people who have looked at this. There are people who have been investing rationally since the beginning of time. And that people are talking section, that widget, those links, can help you to see that there are lots of people who believe in this stuff. So you're not weird or odd or strange if you invest rationally as well, if you take price into consideration when buying stocks as well. So that's what that's about. Now, anyway, that's how this podcast was born, because when I was putting together those links, I came across one, and I don't recall the name of the site off the top of my head, but I think it was a retirement site. And they gave a link to my retirement risk evaluator calculator. I designed that with John Walter Russell. He's the co-creator. He did all the statistical work. He did the hard work. I came up with the catchy name. That's our partnership. I come up with catchy names, and John works his tail off, and we call ourselves co-creators. Anyway, this site said, you know, it was being complimentary. They're friends, and they were saying, you know, go check out this conservative retirement calculator. Nice conservative retirement calculator. Now, they meant that in a totally complimentary kind way, and of course, I'm grateful. Anybody that links to my calculator, I am grateful. However, it troubles me, because the very fact that these people are being kind is what worries me, because they don't really understand the calculator if they're saying it's conservative, because it's not conservative. It's not a conservative calculator. It is not a conservative calculator. Like Linda Ronstadt did, I'll say it again. It's not a conservative calculator. That is not the intent. The intent is that it be an accurate calculator, not a conservative calculator, an accurate calculator. And there's a difference. And there's something in the human mind that makes us want to paper over that difference. And all of our problems with investing over the past 30 years, and in particular, the past 8 months, 12 months, whatever it is now, are the result of the desire to paper over this difference. And I want to stop this. I don't want people papering over that difference. So while I want to be grateful and you know, to anyone who recommends the calculator, I also feel a need to point out that it is not a conservative calculator. It is an accurate calculator, and there's a difference. And we need to get everyone involved in understanding that difference and exploring the implications of the fact that we have such a hard time acknowledging that. That's all the problem we have. We do not have any intellectual problem in investing today. We know the answers intellectually. Our problem is we don't dare to say them out loud. We are afraid to say them. We're afraid to say them because lots of people with big names got the investing ABCs wrong. It's not that they were too liberal or too risky or whatever you want to say. They were wrong. They were wrong. Bad experts. Bad experts. Now, I'm saying that jokingly because there's nothing bad about getting something wrong. It's just something that experts are humans. Just like you and I. We're all humans. And humans make mistakes. It's been going on since the beginning of time. The problem is somebody got it in their head that an investing expert can never get anything wrong. They can never say those three magic words, I was wrong. If you can't say the words, I was wrong, you can never admit a mistake. And if you can never admit a mistake, you can never learn anything, because all learning comes from knowing that you got something wrong and then replacing the wrong knowledge with correct knowledge. If you can never admit a mistake, you're just stuck making the same mistakes over and over and over again. And that's what's been happening. Robert Shiller did the research showing that passive investing can never work in the real world in 1981. That's 28 years ago. It's time to admit this mistake, learn what we can learn from the mistake, and go forward. I'll just real briefly explain the mistake, just because some people listening to this podcast won't have heard the explanation. I'll try to keep it brief. The whole problem, the reason we're suffering an economic crisis today is, and the reason why you've lost so much money out of your retirement account is, and the reason why the investing advice you've heard for 30 years seems so complicated and strange and doesn't work and confusing and makes investors so emotional. Have you noticed how intensely emotional people become when they talk about investing? It's all because of one giant mistake, the biggest mistake ever made in the history of personal finance. There were some people who did some research showing that if smart people try to pick which direction the market's going to go in the next year, they can't do it. They can't do it. And this is where you come up with this stuff about, you know, monkeys throwing darts at dartboards and all this sort of thing. The basic idea was you can check, you know, you can ask somebody, you can ask 10 smart people and say, do you think the market's going to go up or down in the next year? And then you can, you know, just come up with some random answers that a monkey would pick, and the monkeys do just as well. And so the conclusion is this short-term timing stuff doesn't work. And they had to come up with an explanation. These academics, that's sort of their job. This all started with academics. And they said, well, how could that be? And there are two explanations. If you want to hear a full explanation of this, there's a podcast I did called The Candyland Hypothesis. Why short-term timing doesn't work even though long-term timing does. So look for that one. These academics had to come up with an explanation. And there are two possible explanations of why someone would not be able to pick short-term results. They would not be able to figure out if the market's going up or down. One is, the market is perfectly rational. And if the market is perfectly rational, it's impossible to know what's going to happen in 12 months because the market's already factored in every possible reality and you can't possibly know more than the market, and therefore it's a hopeless endeavor. That's one possible explanation of the phenomenon that short-term timing doesn't work. The alternate explanation is the market is totally bonkers. It's just all in the short term, it's just all emotion, and the price means nothing. It's just like random nonsense being generated. And therefore, in order to predict where the market's going to be in a year, you would have to be able to make sense out of this, and you can't make sense out of nonsense. So there are two possible explanations. One is the market is perfectly rational, perfectly efficient, and one is the market is perfectly emotional, perfectly bonkers. And both of them explain the phenomenon. Well, the academics went with the first one. They went with the idea the market's perfectly rational. And the reality is, it's the other one. It's the market is perfectly bonkers in the short term. And so all of the investing advice of the last 30 years is the opposite of what works. So when they tell you stocks are always best for the long run, what they should be telling you is, at some prices, stocks are best for the long run. At some prices, stocks are the worst thing you could be invested in for the long run. There's no investment class as bad as stocks at some prices. The prices we were at from 96 through 2008. You could have been in money markets and did better. Could have been in TIPS or I-bonds, CDs, all kinds of things. Stocks were the worst for the long run and all the other stuff. They say you should never time the market. The reality is you should always time the market. Now, you, of course, don't want to engage in short-term timing since that doesn't work. But you always should be engaged in long-term timing, which means whenever prices go to insane levels, you should be changing your stock allocation to protect your portfolio for the long term. Always. And if you don't do that, you can never get good results. So I don't want to go on and on. I'll get all excited and start on that rip. But that was the mistake. There were two possible explanations for the phenomenon that was noticed, and the experts jumped to the wrong one, and then their egos get involved. Now they don't want to admit the mistake, and now Shiller showed in 1981 that valuations affect long-term returns. If valuations affect long-term returns, passive investing obviously cannot work. You obviously need to change your allocation at different prices since the return changes. And so they got it all wrong. And because they got it wrong, they had middle-class investors investing poorly, and then suffering the results of investing poorly. And because so many of us lost so much money, we're now afraid to spend, and the consumer economy crashes. So we're now in a big fix, and we have to try to rebuild our economy. But if we could tell people about what works in investing, I think we could do that. We could regain confidence in the market, regain confidence in our economic system, regain confidence in our political system. But we've got to figure out a way to get the message to people. All right. The focus here, though, is this question of it's a misunderstanding. And I do want to talk a little bit about the retirement risk evaluator, but I also want to go beyond that, because the implications of what this guy said, who I again is a friend of ours, are very, very profound. Because if our friends are not understanding the message, then you can bet that our enemies are not understanding the message. I'm going to give one example of this and then go specifically to the retirement risk evaluator, because that's what I really wanted to talk about. But I saw this just this morning. There was a thread at the Vanguard Diehards board. It's a great sign that this thread appeared. The thread says, "What do you think of valuation-informed indexing?" Now, valuation-informed indexing is banned at the Vanguard Diehards board. You're not allowed to talk about it. But this guy doesn't know that. He doesn't know that. Mel Lindauer is going to throw a fit when he finds out. But it'll be interesting to see whether Mel Lindauer tries to get the thread removed. And what's happened since the crash is that new people have joined these boards where valuation-informed indexing has been banned, discussion of it has been banned. And these people don't know about the ban, and they're just trying to find out how to invest effectively, and they're asking questions that you're not allowed to ask, but they don't know it. And so Mel's in a bit of a spot. He can say, ban this guy, but what's a Morningstar going to ban them for? All they're doing is asking a question, a perfectly legitimate question. Why shouldn't they be allowed to talk about valuation-informed indexing? Why shouldn't they be allowed to talk about what the historical data says about the effect of valuations on long-term returns? So Mel Lindauer's in a bit of a pickle, and Morningstar's in a bit of a pickle, but it's a very good development for middle-class investors that this fellow asked this question. But he made a very interesting, and again, he's obviously a friend, because he wouldn't go and ask the question. He somehow was connected with John's site and with my site. And so he's asking this question. He's saying, well, when I first looked at this stuff, it sort of sounded like another timing gimmick. But then I thought about it, and I said, you know, this really does make sense. Everything else I buy, the price affects the value proposition. Why wouldn't it be so in stocks? And, of course, the answer is it is so. Price affects the value proposition of stocks just as it affects the value proposition of anything else on planet Earth that can be bought or sold. Common sense. The idea that timing would never work defies common sense. To say timing never works is to say price doesn't matter. It means you buy the same amount, you stay at the same stock allocation regardless of price. Does that make sense? So, the guy's a friend. The guy's smart. The guy's got common sense. But he makes a comment that I found very revealing, and it's very similar. Its philosophical root is the same as the root of the comment where the guy said the retirement risk evaluator is a conservative retirement calculator. The guy said, well, I'm interested in this stuff. I'd like to hear reactions, but, and he says, he gave some caveats. He said, now, I would never, ever let my allocation go below 50%. He says, it makes sense that the value proposition of stocks would not be as good when you get to high prices, but he says, I might change my allocation from, say, 50 to 80, depending on price, but I would never go below 50%. Well, what the guy is saying is, he's saying, I don't care what the facts are. In other words, that's a 100% emotional statement. I'll never go below 50%. Why not? What if the expected long-term return on stocks was a negative 20% a year? Would you stay at 50%? I mean, it's not, and it never has been. But why would someone make a statement like that? He makes the statement because he can't bear to let in the reality that passive investing is insane. He's engaged in passive investing himself for years now. And he's thinking, if, you know, I've been, maybe he stayed at 80% through the crash. Maybe that's the value, you know, the allocation he was at. And he's saying, you know, I've been crushed. And maybe I should go to 50 when prices get where they were from 96 to 2008. Maybe that does make sense. Maybe this Rob Bennett guy's onto something. But I'm never going to go below 50. Because if I go below 50, that means I was really making a mistake. I really screwed up. And he doesn't want to admit that. It's emotional. The unwillingness to acknowledge a mistake is not reason. It's emotion. Now, we're all guilty of this. I did the exact same thing. When I first started, the way I learned about valuation-informed indexing is I first started, I pointed out the errors in the old school safe withdrawal rate studies at the Motley Fool board. And then from that, the discussions became this raging controversy all over the internet. And I learned about valuation-informed indexing, and then I started exploring that and developing calculators. Early in those discussions back at Motley Fool, I had some people ask me, these were supporters of John Graney. John Graney is the author of one of the old school studies. And they said, you have to tell us what allocation you favor. As John was saying 75% was ideal. 75% stocks was ideal. And they said, what do you think? You're saying valuations are high. The ideal stock allocation is lower than 75%. Well, what is it, Mr. Smarty Pants? And I said, look, I said, I don't know. I said, I know it's a lot lower than 75% because it can't be 75% at these prices. If that's the average, that's what John's study determined. He looked at the average. He didn't make any adjustment for valuations. So if that's the average and we're now at, what, two times, I think at the time we were having the discussion, the valuation level was about twice fair value. So I said, it's got to be way lower than 75%, but I don't know what it is. I'm not a statistics guy. And they said, well, you've got to tell us, you know, or we're going to kill you. And I said, well, if you're going to kill me, I'll take a guess. I said, maybe 50? And I said, oh, can't be 50. Well, now that there's been a stock crash, this guy's saying, well, maybe 50. He's where I was back in the summer of 2002. But why did I say 50? I didn't know the facts. Why would you say such a thing? Now, I knew not to say it. I knew it was wrong. But under social pressure, I broke down and said it. And I was wrong. It wasn't 50. It was maybe 20. But the point here is you will not know the realities until you look at the data. You've got to look at the data. But the human mind doesn't want to know the realities. If you've already invested passively, the thought of knowing the realities is frightening because that means you did stuff wrong and that means you hurt yourself and you hurt your loved ones and you hurt your friends and you don't feel good about that. So it's going to take some time to absorb the realities. What we need, what I've said many times, is we need a national debate where everybody can get involved and everybody can join in the learning experience. You know, all middle-class investors, all the experts, Bogle, Bernstein, Burns, Clements, everybody, get involved in a national discussion so that we can all learn together. I've been saying this really from the first day. Motley Fool had a phrase, learning together, and I believe in that phrase. We all should be learning together, but we're not going to learn in 10 minutes. You're not going to learn by looking at a chart and seeing the answer and saying, oh, that's the answer. You have to work through your emotional filters, and that can take years. That's not a one-day job or a one-hour job. And that's really what this podcast is about. It's the point here is that the idea that the retirement risk evaluator is just a conservative retirement calculator, it's essentially buying into the lingo and the thought patterns of the passive investors. That's what's going on there. What's going on is somebody's looking at the calculator and they're saying, well, during the time when stocks were insanely overpriced, there's a lot of these old school retirement. I'll have to explain probably a little bit about what a safe withdrawal rate is. But basically, the safe withdrawal rate research is what financial planners use to tell us how to plan our retirements. So whenever you read an article in the newspaper that says, you know, you should take out X amount from your portfolio each year, 9 times out of 10, the reason they're saying that is they're basing it on the findings of the old school safe withdrawal rate research. And the studies were a big advance. They helped us learn a lot of insights. But they were wrong. And when they were discovered to be wrong, they should have been corrected. And they have not been corrected. And I'm the person who discovered they were wrong. And I said so publicly at a Motley Fool discussion board, and the roof caved in on me. And for 7 years now, the studies have not been corrected. What the studies try to do is to, they look at the historical data. They're objective, not subjective. And this is why I don't like this idea that my calculator is more conservative. That suggests subjectivity. That, you know, they put out a risky calculator, a liberal calculator, and I put out a conservative, safe calculator, and that's just not the way it is. I had no intention whatsoever to be any more conservative than the conventional wisdom. No desire whatsoever. Nothing to do with it. My desire was to be more accurate. My desire was to get the numbers right. Because what I was looking for when I was putting together my retirement plan is, what's going to work? And I don't believe that what's going to work, how can I say this? I was going to say I don't believe that what can work for me is what will work for you. And oh, there are objective truths, and then there are subjective opinions. You have to start with the objective truth. That's what the calculator does. The calculator doesn't tell you what withdrawal rate to use. You can always modify it. You can say, this is what is safe, and I'm going to take something a little bit unsafe. That's a subjective opinion, judgment. And that's perfectly appropriate, of course. The purpose of the calculator was not to bully people into taking more conservative subjective opinions. People should take whatever subjective opinions they care to take. It's none of my business how you put together your plan. My job is to report the numbers accurately so that you can make effective subjective judgment calls. Without the right numbers, you have no hope. This is the problem with the old school studies. It's not that they're not conservative. It's that they are wrong. When you enter the world of mathematics, you enter the world where things are right and wrong. You calculate a number and you have to calculate it right. You have to calculate it properly or else you have to fix it. So, what the old school studies did was they looked at the historical record, and they said there's never been a time when a 4% withdrawal did not, 4% means you take out 4% of your retirement account. So say you had $1 million in your portfolio and you retire at 65 and you figure, well, I'm not going to live past 95. So I need this to work for 30 years. What's the highest amount I can take out every year and be certain that I'm not going to run out of money before I die? And the answer that these studies come up with is if you have an 80% stock portfolio and you're 65, you can take 4% out every year for 30 years and be certain that your retirement's not going to fail, because in the worst case we've ever seen in history, 4% worked. 4% has never not worked. If you take out 4.1, it might not work. But 4% has always worked. So it's safe. That's what the studies say. The error, the analytical error is, what they were looking at is one, there's two cases. I was going to say they're looking at one case. They're really looking at two cases. In modern history, we have two cases where valuation levels went to insanely high levels. One was in the late 1920s, which led to the Great Depression. One was in the mid-1960s, which led to the stagflation of the 1970s. The third case, of course, is the late 1990s, but we haven't seen the results of that yet. We're still living through that. And there's a fourth case if you go way back to the early 1900s. There was a fourth case. Most people don't count that because most people, when they're doing research, they work from 1921 forward, the modern era of investing. So most research goes from the 1920s forward. But if you go all the way back, there's three cases that are not yet in the books and two cases in most studies. So they're looking at two cases and they're saying, well, in case number one, 4% worked. And in case number two, 4% worked. Therefore, 4% is safe. And I'm saying that's insane. I'm saying that's insanely risky to base your retirement plan on two cases. I'm saying these studies should have been taken off the market 7 years ago when the errors were first discovered. You cannot possibly know what is safe by looking at two cases. Now, some people would say, well, how could you know? We only have two cases. What are they supposed to do, Rob? You can't make up historical data. There's only two cases. Well, there are statistical techniques that can be used. The way to do it is, the retirement risk evaluator is based on something called a regression analysis. Now, if you want to know in technical detail what that is, look it up on Wikipedia, but it's a common tactic, it's a common tool of statistical analysis. What you are doing that is magical when you use a regression analysis of the historical data is you aren't looking at just those two cases. You aren't looking at only what happened in the late 1920s and the mid-1960s, which is what these old school studies are doing. When you use a regression analysis, which is what we do with the retirement risk evaluator, you're looking at the entire historical record. You're not looking at only two cases. And you're looking at every year, how much does the valuation level affect the long-term return obtained? And then when you know that, that's you're incorporating that into your analysis of what's safe for a retirement plan. So instead of looking at two cases, see, the problem with the old school studies is they're pretending to tell us what is safe. But they have no way of knowing whether the 4% withdrawal worked because it was safe or because it was lucky. They don't know. Two cases doesn't tell you. It's like saying, I want to find out whether driving drunk 90 miles an hour is safe. And you put a guy in a car who's drunk, legally drunk, and you have him drive 90 miles an hour, and you see whether he lives or die. And lo and behold, he lives. He gets home. He doesn't die. Maybe he gets in an accident, but he doesn't die because they had very, very bad results. In the late 1920s and the mid-60s, they came within a whisker of those retirements failing. So the results were very, very bad. So it's as if your drunk driver got in a multi-car collision, but he was paralyzed for life, but he didn't die. And the second guy, same thing, also paralyzed for life, but he doesn't die. And the conclusion is, hey, not one of these people in these two cases died. This is 100% safe. That's what these studies claim. They say because the two times people tried this insane idea, they almost died. Their retirements came within a whisker of failing, but not quite. That proves that this is a 100% safe withdrawal rate. And I say no. I say you should look at more than two cases. And when you do a regression analysis, that's what you're doing. You're looking, how has valuations affected long-term return throughout the history of the market? And if you factor that into your analysis, you know what you find? You find that a 4% withdrawal rate at the price we were at the top of the bull market, that retirement has only a 30% chance of working. It has a 70% chance of failing. And they're saying it's safe. And I say you shouldn't say that. Now, so that's the difference between the old school and the new school. The old school relies on two cases. See, the way I always put it when I talk about passive investing, I say it's a collection of marketing slogans. You have to distinguish marketing and science. The reason why people believe in passive investing is passive investing uses the trappings of science. It pretends to be science. But most of the quote-unquote science is being promoted by the stock selling industry, people who work in companies that sell us stocks. So a company wants to market its product. It doesn't want scientific analysis of its product. It doesn't want both sides of the stories to be told. It wants to market. So what they do is they craft these studies to be wildly slanted in favor of stocks. So if the safe withdrawal rate is 2%, according to the science, they figure out a way to change the methodology, not necessarily deliberately. But they find out a way to change the methodology so that it shows a much higher, twice as high. Instead of 2%, which is the accurate number, they say 4%. So they encourage people to buy stocks when stocks are exceedingly dangerous. And what I am saying is the thing that they use, the trappings of science, we should make it into real science. We should start reporting the numbers accurately. because they're, I'm saying that passive, the thing that was great about passive investing is they came up with this idea of using objective information. Instead of just saying, my opinion is such and such, they look at data. And I think we need to look at data because otherwise everybody's giving a different opinion. You can't make any sense out of it. You've got to have something objective to ground it in. You, of course, should have differences of opinion. But we've got to ground it in something real. And that's what the passive investors did. But where they went wrong was they said, well, we don't want to report the science accurately. We want to slant it. And I don't think they necessarily did this deliberately. I think it's cognitive dissonance. They believe themselves, I think a lot of them, in the passive investing stuff. But whether they believe it or not doesn't make it true. It's wrong. If you want to do it scientifically, you've got to adjust for valuations. There's just no ifs, ands, buts about it, in Rob Bennett's opinion. So the numbers are wrong. So the point I want to make is I don't like it when people describe valuation-informed indexing and all the other investing ideas put forward at my website as conservative ideas. They are not conservative ideas. Now, there's a very dramatic illustration of that point that I can make, and I wrote a blog entry about it once. You can find the blog entry by doing a search at the blog, and I don't recall the exact title of the blog entry. It's something like, can a 9% withdrawal rate ever be safe? I think that's the title, something like that. And I think it's a good analysis. It looks at quite a few factors, about half a dozen factors, and concludes that yes, a 9% withdrawal rate can be safe. Now, I've had all these battles with people defending, quote unquote, defending the old school studies. They never defend them in terms of logic. They defend them by threatening to kill my children. That's about the only defense they've ever put forward. And this includes big names, have done this. I mean, it's goon posters that deliver the physical threats, but a lot of big names have been in on the discussions and have done nothing. So it's a widespread phenomenon. It's a big problem. The people who believe in the old school studies say that 4% is the safe withdrawal rate. And I say, they say 4%. And I say, no, at the top of the bubble, it was 2%. And they say, you're insane. You know, get out of here. We have to ban you from our board. You're insane. Dangerous. Mel Lindauer said it was dangerous to let people know what the historical data says about safe withdrawal rates. Dangerous. That's a quote. He used the word dangerous. Somebody asked him, why are you posting so abusively? Why are you trying to block this? And he said, it's dangerous. We have to protect the newcomers, protect the newbies. We can't let them hear this dangerous reporting on what the historical data says. Dangerous. So I say 2%. I say 2%, they say 4%. Now, in the wake of an out-of-control bull market, ordinarily you're going to go to half. You're going to go to valuation levels half of fair value. So, like I said early in the podcast, the likelihood is, we're not certain, but probably a 70% possibility is, we're going to see another stock crash that will bring us to a P10 level about half of what we are today. Perhaps we'll go to 7 or 8. P10 level 7 or 8. Fair value P10 levels 14, 15. So, we're probably going to go to half. Now, if you go to half, you can go to the Retirement Risk Evaluator. It's at the website, free calculator, and you can enter in a P10 level of 8 and see what is the safe withdrawal rate. Say that you retired not at the top of the bull market, but 3 years from now when the P10 level is 8. What would your safe withdrawal rate be? If the safe withdrawal rate were 4%, just to make this easy, if you had a $1 million portfolio on the day you retired, the old school studies are telling you can take out $40,000 a year for 30 years and be certain that that would work. And it's inflation adjusted. So it's $40,000 the first year, and then there's an inflation. You take out more the second year. $40,000 inflation adjusted for the rest of your life is safe. The correct calculation, the Retirement Risk Evaluator said, if you retired in January of 2000 and you had $1 million, you could only take out $20,000, not $40,000, $20,000. if you went with stocks. Now, if you move to tips, of course, you could take out 58,000. The safe withdrawal rate for 100% tips was at in January 2000 was 5.8. So you could, you know, if you went to some other asset class, you could take out far more. But we're talking about an 80% stock portfolio. That's what they use in the studies. They were looking at high stock portfolios. So I was saying 20,000, they were saying 40,000. Now, obviously, that makes a big difference. If you're planning a retirement, whether you live on 20,000 for the rest of your life or you live on 40,000, makes a big difference. It's not a small, you know, thing. Well, say we go to 8. The retirement risk evaluator was saying you could take out 90,000, 9%. And the old school studies are still going to say 4. So is that conservative? I'm not conservative. I'm saying you can take out double, more than double. So there's nothing conservative about it. The goal here is not to be conservative. Now, the safe withdrawal rate studies are conservative. That's fair to say. The whole idea of a safe withdrawal rate analysis is you look at the worst case scenario. That's what you're doing. So all safe withdrawal rate analysis is conservative by definition. And on our calculator, we actually have a way where if you want to be less conservative, you can find out what the numbers are. We report the safe withdrawal rate, you know, what the historical data says, say it's today, I think it's, well, I don't want to say what it is because the P10 levels change, but say you're looking at it at a time when the safe withdrawal rate is 5%. That's the number that works. We say it's 90% safe. Because statistically, you can never really get to 100%. But, according to the regression analysis, it's got a 90% chance of working out. Actually, 95, because there's a 5% error on each end of the spectrum. So 90, it's actually a 95% chance of working out. There's only a 5% chance, statistically, that won't work. We call that safe. That's the safe withdrawal rate. So the worst case scenario. That number is close, you know. I mean, obviously, it's safer to take less, but statistically, there's a 95% chance that'll work, so we call that safe. But we allow you to enter in any percentage safety you want. So, for example, you could enter, we'll tell you the number that's 80% safe statistically, and that's obviously going to be a higher number. But in other words, you can take maybe, I don't know what the number, say it's 5.3. So, in other words, if you're happy to have only an 80% chance of your retirement working out, we'll tell you the number. But again, is that being less conservative or more conservative? No. It's just telling you a number. It's just being accurate. Obviously, if you only want 80% probability that your retirement will work, the number's going to be higher. I mean, that's common sense. But the point here is, I believe that the goal of a retirement calculator is not to be conservative or liberal. It's to be accurate. And my claim, I'm happy to be proven wrong if somebody can prove me wrong. Nobody has in 7 years. But I'd love it if someone gave it a sincere effort. My claim is the passive investing model is wrong. I do not say it's too liberal. I do not say it's too, you know, too risky. I say it is wrong. I say, and this is the reason for all the friction we've seen. It's because the people who advocate passive investing understand this, at least on some level of consciousness. They know that I'm not saying to be more conservative. I am saying to be accurate, and they don't want to take that on. If they admit that the safe withdrawal rate numbers are wrong, they're admitting the entire passive investing model is wrong. And they don't want to do it because that means rewriting all the textbooks, you know, admitting that Money Magazine's been getting it wrong for 35 years, you know, admitting that John Bogle's gotten it wrong for 30 years, all this sort of thing, and they don't want to do it. It means that we'd have to start telling people, every time we tell them the Dow and we tell them the S&P, we'd have to tell them the P10 level, and they don't want to do it. That's the problem. So the problem here is not a question of being more or less conservative. The problem is, are we willing to be accurate? And I'm saying we have to be. Once we know the numbers are wrong, I mean, I think it was an honest mistake when the mistake was made. But once we learn the mistake, my view is we have to correct it. If we're going to have investing advice that is rooted in objective evidence, we're going to have to be scientific about presenting that evidence, which means you have to report when you make mistakes, because that's how scientists learn. You can't say we're going to take a snapshot in time, we're going to go by what we knew in 1978, and then we're never going to change, because that would be embarrassing. So is it possible that 9% could be safe? When I was first writing that blog entry, I thought, this is going to be a hard one to write, because I don't know if I believe, would I personally, if I had a friend, and say that the P10 level was 8, would I tell that person, yeah, go feel free to take 90,000 out a year on a $1 million portfolio? Well, what I'll say is this. It's up to the individual whether he takes 90,000. You know, that's a personal call. He's got to live with the consequences, and, you know, he's a fool. If he goes by what Rob Bennett says, he's got to think about it himself. Rob Bennett's job is just to educate him to the extent I can, you know, based on what I've learned. Report what I've learned and give him links, whatever he needs, and then say good luck. But do I believe, you know, it's been an interesting question, do I believe that you could take 90,000 out safely? And the answer is yes, I do. I've always said I would like to have millions of people discussing this stuff. I don't think it's good or healthy, you know, to just have a small number of people exploring valuation-informed indexing. We need to have millions. We need to have a national debate, because that's the only way. I have a podcast where I list the 10 caveats. You know, why would valuation-informed indexing not work? I think I call it something like the downside of valuation-informed indexing, something like that. I think that's good. You know, people need to be aware of that. But I can't point out all the downsides myself. I need John Bogle helping out, and I need Bill Bernstein helping out, and I need Jonathan Clemens helping out, and Scott Burns helping out, and I can't get them helping out unless they're willing to talk about it. But ultimately, we need that. But so I would never tell someone just to go by what Rep Bennett says and take 90,000 out. However, if you start with the caveat that all we're talking about here is, you know, Rob Bennett's little brain and what he's capable of understanding, I think it makes sense that 90,000 would be safe. Now, let me define safe. By safe, I mean as safe as 2% was at the top of the bubble. That's what I mean by safe. In other words, 2% wasn't 100% safe. If somebody says, could there have been a nuclear war and the U.S. would be blown up and 2% would fail? You know, it wouldn't. The retirement plan wouldn't work? Of course, there's always a chance of a nuclear war. But what I'm trying to tell you in the calculator is, what's the equivalent level of safety? And I think 9% at a P10 level, for a retirement that begins at a P10 level of 8, is just as safe as 2% for a retirement that begins at a P10 level of 44. Which is where we were in January 2000. Now, think this through just for a second. If you're going to take out 90,000 compared to somebody taking out 20,000, you're taking out almost five times as much. And that shocks us. You know, that's why people think it's incredible. They look at it and they say, how could that be? How could one guy can only take out 20,000 and the other can take out 90? That doesn't seem right. It's fantastic. But think about it a little bit. The P10 level for the guy that's going to take out 90,000 is 8. The P10 level for the guy who's only going to take out 20,000 was 44. That's just very simplistic. But let's just compare the P10 levels. How much bigger is 44 than 8? 8, 16, 24, 32, 40, 48. 48 would be six times as high. So at a P10 level of 48, I mean, being very simplistic, you would think that the takeout would be 1/6. And it turns out, you know, the takeout is about five times. And the P10 level at 44, which is lower than 48. It makes sense. Now, again, I don't think that that's a I don't think you can you can't compare the numbers that way. I don't think that works. But it's just a very sort of simple-minded way of looking at it. The point is, the valuation level, if we go to a P10 level of 8, will be nothing compared to what it was in January 2000. And you wouldn't expect the takeout to be anything similar. Why would you think the takeout would be the same? What would make you think such a thing? It's the passive investing mindset that has led us to believe that the takeout could be the same at different valuation levels. It's crazy thinking. But we've bought into it. We bought into it because when you start thinking, when you adopt the passive investing mindset, what you're really doing is saying, I'm turning my brain off today, and I'm never going to use my brain again when it comes to investing decisions. I use my brain when I buy cars and comic books and bananas, but when it comes to buying stocks, no. My brain is off, and I've thrown away the key. I'm a passive investor. I shout marketing slogans. Whenever I get anxious about having turned my brain off, I just tell myself the timing doesn't work and buy and hold and stocks for the long run. I shout marketing slogans, but I've turned my brain off. And the whole idea of rational investing is to turn your brain back on. Your common sense tells you that the amount you can take out of your retirement portfolio is going to differ based on the valuation level that applies on the day the retirement begins. Now, is that fair? Some people will say, well, that's not fair. They'll say, this guy, say that we're at a P10 level of 8 in 2011, 2 years from now. They're saying, this isn't fair. This guy that retires January 1, 2011, he gets to take out, he's got $1 million, and he gets to take out $90,000 a year. Nice life on $90,000 a year. The guy that retired in January 2000, he can only take out, he's also got $1 million saved, and he only gets to take out $20,000 a year. That's not right. That can't be right. That's not fair. It is fair. Why is it fair? Because the guy who retired in January of 2000, he might have had $1 million in his portfolio, but the odds are very strong he didn't put in $1 million. He might have put in a third of that. And it was those insane gains of the late 90s pumped it up temporarily to $1 million. He didn't put in $1 million. So it's perfectly fair that he only gets to take out $20,000. Maybe $300,000 of that $1 million is real and $700,000 is cotton candy nonsense. It's not real. It's all that was happening in the 90s is we were borrowing returns from the future. So it was all borrowed money. It wasn't real. It's as if you were saying, you know, I should be able to buy a big house because, you know, I've got lots of credit cards, you know, and the credit cards will let me borrow thousands and thousands, and I can buy whatever I want. If you buy it on credit cards, you're not going to be able to make the payments because you never really had the money in the first place. It's all baloney. There was no reality to that portfolio. He said, you know, nominally, his account said he had $1 million, but it wasn't $1 million real. It was just $1 million cotton candy, maybe $300,000 real. Now compare that to the guy in 2011, retiring at a P10 level of 8. He's got $1 million nominally, but does he really have $1 million? No. If the P10 level was 8, that's half fair value. That means that his portfolio has been marked down to half of what it is really worth. That's what it means when we say half fair value. The fair value is double. It's $2 million. Well, why, if he's got a $2 million portfolio, is it really that shocking that he can take out $90,000 a year? Based on the real numbers, that's only a little bit above 4. The number that all the old schoolers think is just great. So is it so shocking that the numbers, when calculated accurately, tell him he can take out $90,000? I don't think so. What's going on here is that we have gotten used to following an investing model, which is wrong, was based on a mistake. Honest people, smart people, good people made a mistake, and they said, you don't have to look at valuations. Because of this mistake we made, we have concluded that passive investing can work. You don't need to look at valuations. As a result, every analysis done since then based on that model, and it's 90% of what you hear for the past 30 years, is wrong. And now we have a situation where we're saying, are we going to admit the mistake and let people invest effectively from this point forward? Are we going to continue to pretend that it doesn't matter, that we got the numbers wrong? And I'm saying we've got to acknowledge the problem, because the problem isn't some small thing. And that's why I don't like it when they say it's conservative. The suggestion is it's just, oh, you know, both sides are right. It's just one's a little more cautious than the other. That's papering over the difference. The difference here is not a difference of judgment. It's not a difference of how risky you're willing to be. It's a difference of whether you're willing to acknowledge that valuations have an effect or not. If valuations have an effect, any study that does not count valuations is analytically invalid. And once we accept that valuations have an effect, it changes the history of investing. Every bit of material at the PassionSaving.com site is based on the idea that valuations affect long-term returns. So every single bit of it shows how investing works in a world in which valuations affect long-term returns, which is the opposite of the world imagined by the passive investing advocates. That's what this is about. So the retirement risk evaluator is not a conservative retirement calculator. I don't take any position on how conservative or liberal you should be in deciding how much to take out of your portfolio. That's your call. It's none of my darn business. You want to take a chance. You want to go, if you want to, you can go with a withdrawal rate that has only a 30% chance of working with my blessing. If you were retiring in January of 2000 and you said, Rob, I see your calculator. I see that this has only a 30% chance of working, but you know what? I'm feeling lucky and I'm going to take it. You know what Rob Bennett would say to you? I'd say, good luck, friend. If you know what you're doing and you decide to go with a retirement plan that has only a 1 in 3 chance of working, I'll say a prayer for you, because it's your business. It's none of my business. I don't get involved in it. I don't discuss what's safe, really, and what's risky. When I discuss what's safe, I don't mean in terms of how conservative or what's conservative and what's liberal. That's none of my business. What I try to do is calculate the safe number accurately. The literature says the thing defined as the safe withdrawal rate is the worst case scenario. So I try to calculate the worst case scenario and then tell people what that number is. And at the top of the bubble, that number was not 4%, it was 2%. And if we go down to a P10 level of 8, that number will not be 4%, it will be 9%. And yes, a 9% withdrawal rate is every bit as safe. A 9% withdrawal rate for a retirement beginning at a P10 level of 8 is every bit as safe as a retirement portfolio calling for a 2% withdrawal that begins at a time when the P10 level is 44. We can't make strategic decisions on investing unless we know the numbers. No one withdrawal rate is going to work for all of us, because some of us are more risky than others. Some might say, Rob, that 2% was safe at January 2000, but I want a little slack. I'm not going to take 2%. I'm going to take 1%. And I'd say, fine, that's your call. But we can't even begin to make sense out of investing until we can know the accurate numbers. And until we can overcome the promotion of passive investing, we can't know the right numbers. There's no way a passive investing advocate can ever tell you accurate numbers. It's impossible. Because valuations are the single biggest factor in success. And passive investors can't look at it. That's what it means to be passive. To be passive means to stay at the same stock allocation regardless of valuations. So I've gone over time again, as I always do. But anyway, I'm grateful for the website. that recommended the calculator, but I do want to take exception to the idea that this is a conservative calculator. The retirement risk evaluator is not a conservative retirement calculator. It is an accurate retirement calculator, or at least so Rob Bennett says. If someone can find it's not accurate, you know, that'll be the next podcast, you know. I want people to know that. But I believe it's the only accurate retirement calculator on the internet today, because it is the only retirement calculator on the internet today that factors in the effect of the valuation level that applies on the day you retire. When we reach a point where those who have advocated passive investing can develop the good grace to permit honest posting on these questions throughout the internet, we can all enjoy a wonderful learning experience. And there will be lots of discussion about, when the safe withdrawal rate is 9%, should you really take 9%, or should you take more than that? Should you be willing to be, you know, only 80% safe? Maybe you can take 10. Or should you be super conservative and only take 8? People can discuss these questions, and we can have fruitful discussions and learn all sorts of things by having people from all sorts of life experiences participate. But we can't get to square one unless we can acknowledge that valuations must have an effect, and there ain't no way on God's green earth you could ever know the safe withdrawal rate without factoring in the valuation level that applies on the day the retirement begins. It just doesn't make sense. Good luck with your investing strategies. You take care.